So we'll be looking at Sutta 142 from the Majjhima Nikaya, and that's the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta that was proposed by Hugh. I read through this a couple of times. This one's it's pretty deep stuff, so we'll just see how we go. And what I'll do is, I've got the footnotes on the side here, but what I'll just check with people. I'll read through a couple of paragraphs, and then I'll just check if anyone has any views, opinions, any ideas on the content. So I'll let you guys speak first before I add any of my own spiel. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatu in Nagrodha's park. Then Mahapachapati Gotami took a new pair of cloths and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, she sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this new pair of cloths has been spun by me, woven by me, especially for the Blessed One. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept it from me out of compassion." When this was said, the Blessed One told her, "Give it to the Sangha, Gotami. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and to the Sangha." A second time and a third time she said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, accept it from me out of compassion." A second time and a third time, the Blessed One told her, "Give it to the Sangha, Gotami. When you give it to the Sangha, the offering will be made both to me and to the Sangha." So in reference with the footnotes, it's quite interesting in the sense, as many of you understand, that Mahapachapati Gotami was the younger sister of Queen Mahamaya, the Buddha's mother. So this is the lady who essentially wet nursed and raised the Buddha when he was a young baby, after his own mother had actually passed away after his birth. And she provided the milk, and she raised him as a young child. And when you check the canonical account of the founding of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, this shows that when you actually look at the chronological order, you will see that Mahapachapati Gotami, she was the first historical Bhikkhuni in the ordination lineage. And in addition, when this particular reference, when you look at that footnote of that 1292, the Buddha's recommendation to actually give to the Sangha in total, by giving to the Sangha, she maximized her wholesome merit. He also said that, in addition to this, that later generations would be inspired to show respect towards the Sangha, and by supporting the Sangha with the four physical requisites which contribute towards the longevity of the dispensation. So Ajahn Brahm also makes this reference from time to time, because he's the senior teacher up at the monastery, and because he's very well known internationally, he tends to a lot of both say material and financial support tends to come his way for the greater, not only just the monastery, but also for the Dhammaloka, for the nuns' monastery, and also the smaller projects like the Hermit's Hill project, where the house there will probably take maybe another full year to build, and also Venerable Jagannatha's place outside of Melbourne, where I popped in for 6 weeks and helped him out to get established, and some small projects and whatnot. And because I was connected with some of the senior members of BSV who'd been essentially helping out even over like 20 to 30 years, and they were very well aware that they wouldn't be able to get their own place together within a reasonable time frame without Seachan Brom's backing and support. So he's very, very, as you understand, very well known, very quite high powered on the both within the Singaporean, Malaysian, and Indonesian support fraternity, and Thailand to a smaller degree. And also with the four physical requisites, which are the basic requisites for the monks and the nuns' life, and also even with the eight precept lay disciples, you know, in training within the, you know, some of the monastic facilities, that, you know, the four basic requisites, you know, essentially you need in order to live this life. The food, you know, the food, at least say one daily meal, which the vast, you know, say probably 90% of the population can survive on, and continue the practice, and just the basic dwelling. You know, when you're looking at the historical setting, you know, one main meal that you collect from the local villages, or possibly even prepared inside the monastery, and just a basic shelter, like could be like a straw hut, or maybe like a timber frame kuti design, just something quite simple. And the medicine, which is the foundation medicine, was the fermented cow's urine, which has quite a number of applications. It's like a similar principle to the way we would use vinegar. So the way vinegar was used both in traditional and folk medicine, you know, the fermented vinegar, you know, can have like absolutely dozens and dozens of different applications, with, you know, antibacterial healing, you know, maintaining internal health, and antiseptic qualities. And so looking at food, shelter, medicines, and the basic set of robes, you know, enough robes to cover the physical body. And point three, then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One accept the new pairs of cloths from Mahapatipatigotami. Mahapatipatigotami has been very helpful to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir. As his mother's sister, she was his nurse, his foster mother, the one who gave him milk. She suckled the Blessed One when his own mother died. The Blessed One, too, has been very helpful to Mahapatipatigotami. Venerable Sir, it is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapatipatigotami has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapatipatigotami abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapatipatigotami possesses perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and that she possesses the virtues loved by the noble ones. It is owing to the Blessed One that Mahapatipatigotami is free from doubt about suffering, about the origin of suffering, about the cessation of suffering, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. The Blessed One has been very helpful to Mahapatipatigotami." That is so, Ananda, that is so. When one person, owing to another, has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to them, rising up for them, according them reverential salutation and polite services, and by providing robes, armed food, resting places, and medicinal requisites. So, that naturally, that gets repeated several times, and there's quite a lot of emphasis placed on this. And when you check the footnotes, that supposedly the Mahapatipati Gautama was actually a stream enterer at that stage, and many of you understand when you see that emphasis, when a disciple is recognised as having, say, full faith in the Buddha. I mean, when we talk about full faith, we're talking about 100% full faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And when you are at that level on a reality principle, that essentially that person is at the Sotapanna level. And they also contain being that four factors of stream entry, the recognition of the stream entry state, and that the containing the virtues which are dear to the noble ones. So all Sotapannas have a very high level of natural morality, which is imbued due to the inherent purity of the mind. It's not like a kind of purity which is acted out. For example, you can have very, very good monks and nuns and who've been practicing for minimum, say, 20, 30 years, and they can give the appearance of being very, very pure-minded, and naturally they will be automatically restrained and polite and compassionate, and they will fulfill their role to the best of their ability. But it doesn't mean that you actually have the real purity of that level, actually within the mind. It's a permanent state. It's not something that you just see within the external form. So when one person, owing to another, has come to abstain from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wine, liquor, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to them, in addition to the medicinal requisites. When one person, owing to another, has come to possess perfect confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and to possess the virtues loved by noble ones, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to them, in addition to medicinal requisites. When one person, owing to another, has become free from doubt about suffering, the origin, the cessation, and about the way leading to the cessation of suffering, I say that it is not easy for the former to repay the latter by paying homage to them and supporting them with the four requisites of the spiritual life. So for example, if you attained to the Sotapanna level, say under the guidance and the tutelage of the Buddha, by even though that is it's the first level of the first of the four enlightenment levels, that when you reach that point and the Buddha has actually guided you and brought you to that point, that emphasis on you can't not only the Buddha but any teacher who brings you to that level, they could be a stream enterer themselves, and which gives them the ability. They may not necessarily have the full faculties, but it gives them the ability to guide and train and lead you to that state. Because there was a point which came up in the car as we were coming in with one of the community members, and with all the monks and nuns and also the lay disciples who've especially attained to the enlightenment stages, that essentially as a reality principle, you can't bring another, you can teach a person up to that point, but you can't take them beyond that point because, you know, essentially the path, it's very much, it's a feely-feely path. It's an experiential path, and you can't teach somebody something that you haven't realized within yourself, because when you look at the nature of the mind and you look at the 10 fetters which bind a person in samsara, you know, as you're well aware, you basically cut the 3 fetters, 3 of the 10 at the level of sotapanna, you attenuate or say cut away roughly about 50% of lust, hate and aversion. This is a very rough guide. When you speak with forest teachers and they ask you, or you ask them, how much of the defilements in the mind do you actually remove as you move from level to level? And in a rough sense, at the sotapanna has cleared 25% of all defilement, of all spiritual obstructions inside the mind. The Sakadagami, 50%, the Anagami, 75%, and the Arahant has essentially purified the mind completely. And so essentially when you're talking about, say, levels of real purity, you actually have to consider that as a basis. And additions. So there are 14 kinds of personal offerings, Ananda. One gives a gift to the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. This is the first kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a Pacheka Buddha, which is a silent Buddha, which essentially is a person who has naturally attained full enlightenment. And going from the canonical description, I haven't seen like that many references with the level of the spiritual faculties. But when the emphasis is that the Pacheka Buddha, from what I understand, but I haven't seen an exact reference on this, it's something I better check in some other files, is should have taken the the paramis. You know, when they talk about, say, like the 10 paramis within the mind frame of a fully enlightened Buddha. You know, there's the wisdom. You know, the wisdom, the samadhi, the generosity, the patience, the equanimity. What else is there? The metta, compassion. You know, there's 10 of these in total, and it's known that the Tathagata has fulfilled all those 10 qualities to their maximum level. They've essentially have been taken to their highest degree, and theoretically the Pacheka Buddha should be at the same level, otherwise they wouldn't use this description, say like Buddha, you know, as a terminology. But the Pacheka Buddha is what they call a silent Buddha, becomes, you know, fully accomplished, but the person, for God knows what reason, doesn't actually go out there and teach the dispensation to his full capability. It's a bit of an unusual. It's something I have to look into. They call the Pacheka Buddha a silent Buddha, but I find it quite unusual in the sense that they're known to be solitary teachers, you know, solitary practitioners, you know, sort of like hermits in a sense. But you know, when you're that highly developed, you know, across the range. You know, I find it a bit unusual that a person of that level and understanding, you know, wouldn't be motivated to actually instruct and save other beings in samsara. So I haven't come across any references on the, say, like the mind state, the life stories of Pacheka Buddhists. There must be some material there. Somebody had a comment? Yep. Yeah, that's correct. And but I find it quite unusual, and there's a thought which has come up in my mind in relation to this, that when this is just a slight sidetrack. When Achyut Chah actually came to England, when he was invited by the Buddhist Sangha Trust in London to send monks to England to set up a facility to teach people, that when Achyut Chah came to visit, to examine the lay of the land and the potential support and the key people who were interested in setting up a society and the support network. So there was a particular incident which took place, which gave gave Achyut Chah a sense of dispassion. I mean, I better tell you what it is, but you might think it's a bit funny, but because he'd come from a very, I wouldn't say completely sheltered background, but very, very simple, lifestyle in northeast Thailand. That he was walking through the suburbs in London, and he passed a newspaper stand, and on the newspaper stand there were magazines, portraying, women and young women in the Playboy format, and sort of classification of magazines. And when he saw that the girly magazine format, he felt that the minds of the general population were so far gone, getting into this particular type of thing. He felt like dismayed and disappointed. And he said to Longpo Samedo, he said, how can you teach people, when people are basically absorbing this kind of material in day to day life? It was just an indication of the level of people's defilements. We in modern life, some people may feel that it's not such a big deal, girly magazines and the beefcake magazines for the ladies and the stuff that you see on the web. But with Achyut Chah coming from that very, very simple background and seeing the level of sensuality which was being advertised, just on the local fraternity, he was very, very dismayed. And you said to Longpo Samedo, he said, how can you instruct people when their minds are at this level? But even within ourselves, that any of you who have internet access are exposed to this kind of material just constantly. You don't think it's a big deal, and you naturally it will. There's absolutely no doubt this kind of material will slow people's practice right down. It's a common understanding. This kind of exposure. So one gives to a Pacheka Buddha. This is the second kind of person offering. One gives a gift to an Arahant disciple of the Tathagata. This is the third kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of arahantship. This is the fourth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a non-returner. This is the fifth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of non-return. This is the sixth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a once-returner. This is the seventh kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of one's return. This is the eighth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to a stream enterer. This is the ninth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of stream entry. This is the tenth kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to one outside the dispensation, which is outside the Buddha's teaching, who is free from lust, from sensual pleasures. So that footnote there is 1, 2, 9, 6. And so when you look at that, actually, any of you got an opinion before I go forward? So with that footnote, that 1, 2, 9, 6, and this. These levels of merit or personal offerings to people from at the highest level, the person who's the fully enlightened Buddha, Pacheka Buddha, moving right down through the different levels of enlightened beings, and if you move down, this principle here gives a gift to one to outside the dispensation who's free from lust for sensual pleasures. Essentially, that individual, when we're talking at that level, you're looking at a person who they've got to have the jhanas mastered at least to a medium degree. So, if you've got say full mastery of the first jhana, and you're able to maintain that constantly on a day-to-day basis, you actually don't see the five hindrances in the mind as long as you are able to maintain that state of samadhi, meditation. And if you say, for example, you get a person who has the fourth jhana samadhi and the mind is incredibly pure, and the person who maintains that on a day-to-day basis, who are incredibly skilled in that level of meditation, they don't see their defilements whatsoever. You just can't see it. The mind is very, very pure on the both on the surface to the intermediate. You can't see the underlying like energies and forces in the mind. And as a little bit of a sidetrack to even at the very highest stages, the person who's attained to anagami, and there's been a couple of cases like this, where the person had been an anagami for minimum, say, 5 to 10 years, and the mind is incredibly, the way they describe it, incredibly pure, bright, radiant. The insight knowledge just flows effortlessly for that person. At that third level of the enlightenment stages, and you can't. The mind is so refined, you don't see that's an incredibly high level of attainment, and even that person can't see the five higher fetters, the five remaining fetters which bind the person to samsara. So, which is attachment to rupa jhanas, arupa jhanas, conceit. The self conceit of I am, the trace of the ego, and restlessness, which is incredibly refined restlessness, and that last trace of ignorance or delusion in relation to so both insight knowledge and the nature of the mind, the way the mind works. One gives a gift to a virtuous ordinary person. This is the 12th kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to an immoral ordinary person. This is the 13th kind of personal offering. One gives a gift to an animal. This is the 14th kind of personal offering. So herein, Ananda, by giving a gift to an animal, the offering may be expected to repay 100-fold. By giving a gift to an immoral ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay 1,000-fold. By giving a gift to a virtuous ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000-fold. By giving a gift to one outside the dispensation, the Buddha's teaching, who is free from lust for sensual pleasures, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000 times, 100,000-fold. By giving a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of stream entry, the offering may be expected to repay incalculably, immeasurably. So, right. Yeah, so with this principle, this takes you up to that that footnote of 1298, where as you move from this point, and it's said that although the results of giving in each of the following cases is incalculable, they talk about like ascending gradations in their incalculability. So it's essentially when you're looking at the quality, the level of being, say the first one where it was in incalculable, and then they move on to the next level and it's supposed to be even more incalculable. But what one of the references there was that they're considering the lifespan, one of the factors in relation to this word that they use as far as a state being incalculable, as far as the development of wholesome merit, is when you go back through the rebirth process. And as many of you understand, that the process of karma and rebirth in samsara, you know, there's not supposed to be a beginning point, like a starting point for, you know, for the this process of delusion and process of rebirth and karma. So you know all of us are supposedly been moving through in samsara since beginningless time, you know, not from any kind of creation point, starting point on any level. You know, essentially, you know, the consciousness, the mind consciousness of human beings being propelled through the rebirth process. But this position of incalculability takes you can I didn't find it incredibly that well explained, because when you talk about incalculable, you would think that it would extend in an unlimited range. The rebirth process has an unlimited range, but the lifespans of the beings who are the recipients, who receive that incalculable level of merit, may be limited. You know, so for example, you have the Sotapanna, maximum of 7 lifetimes, or you could have a person, usually don't go past the second lifetime as a Sotapanna, unless by choice. And you could have beings who make an intention to be a bodhisattva, and they choose to keep delaying the realization of nibbana. It's a bit of a paradox. So you know, you can have a series of lifetimes, either short or long terms. And say, for example, you had a person who made the determination to be a bodhisattva and would intentionally delayed their realization of enlightenment. You know, they have this principle within the Mahayana sect of Buddhism, that the individual, the disciple, the follower, makes the determination to not to enter nibbana until all beings are saved. But the thing is, it's not really a reality principle, because the Buddha said in the suttas that the number of beings is, you know, you can't count them. It's like numberless. There's an unlimited quantity or number of beings in samsara. So if you talk about saving all beings before you gain enlightenment, and gain enlightenment yourself, that, you know, that's just not a realistic possibility. And and in order to enlighten another person on a practical level, you've got to be at that level yourself. You know, you've got to know the path to, you know, that first level of realization. Otherwise, you haven't got a hope of teaching another individual. It's like the blind leading the blind. So it can be one of the limitations within the Mahayana system that some people may not necessarily get their minds around. They've also got this principle of but this is like a scholarly invention, creation, where they talk about, say, like arahants and Buddhas actually existing in other world systems, you know, in other universe world systems. And a senior teacher I met in the Chan tradition, who is not a silly person whatsoever, incredibly well-read and well-studied, but he'd studied his own texts to a quite high degree, but he hadn't studied our texts to even a moderate degree at all. And this guy was pretty intelligent and done a lot of study over 30, 40 years. And, you know, he firmly believed in that about this principle of cosmic Buddhas and enlightened disciples in other worlds, which is quite possible. You can have the person at the Sotapanna and the Sakadagami level, first and second level of enlightenment. Realistically, you will find them in the Devaloka realms, and, you know, right through the Brahmaloka realms, up to the level of the pure abodes. The pure abodes are designated for the five different categories of anagamis. I can't basically tell you straight off the cuff the discrepancy between the five groups, and so those individuals at the third stage of enlightenment remain in that state, and they pass away completely after the karma, which has actually brought them to that state. It's more like the principle, the reality principle is when the anagami arises, the five types of anagami arise in the Suddhavasa, that there is still, as you understand, there's still like a trace of defilement left in the mind. There's still the residue of the five high fetters remaining in the mind, but that those particular fetters essentially become expired, you know, from that world after they've lived the full lifespan and they attained the full Nibbana state from the Suddhavasa into attained to the full pure purification of the Arahant, and they pass away completely and the mind body process ceases completely. Yep, yep. Yeah, so it's quite an altruistic kind of mentality, but yeah, essentially you're coming from the standpoint of the self, but the you know, I haven't studied Mahayana say philosophy or Abhidharma to any great degree, but the Mahayana system, that element of the Bodhisattva and the cosmic Buddhas and this that level of teaching, that it's that didn't come from the Buddha never taught that. That actually comes from through the development, the literature development of the Mahayana scholars. And you know, you can easily there are specific books you can get online, and you can actually follow the chronology, the way the teaching was gradually formulated, you know, from the Theravada to the Mahayana style. But essentially the additions that you see within the Mahayana doctrine, they are a scholar's creation. And you know, any person who's attained the Enlightenment stages will state that very clearly, because they understand, you know, within themselves, at the mind level, the process of karma and rebirth and dependent origination. You know, they understand. There's a number of essential insights which will not allow you to essentially be fooled by this scholarly invention within the Mahayana fraternity. And but the reason this actually came about, this was brought up by a Theravadan scholar, and the historical, let's get my memory right, the historical development why the Mahayana actually started to become formulated through in history was that in the beginning you had the forest tradition fraternity, you know, as you understand, that you had the lifestyle that the Buddha was living in the early days as a practitioner, living in the forest, living in simple dwellings under a tree, just one meal a day, that you do your food collection from the local villages, and a very, very simple, uncomplicated spiritual lifestyle on a day-to-day basis. But there were a number of people within the Sangha, both monks, nuns, and lay disciples, who weren't able to sustain the rigors, withstand the harsh conditions, you know, the deprivation, you know, being exposed to the elements, being exposed to sickness, being exposed to discomfort, and things like mosquitoes. You know, anyone who goes to say Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, you know, you get exposed to mosquitoes and leeches and ticks and parasites, especially if you're living in the jungles. I mean, these little creatures just eat you alive, you know, without a mosquito net, and naturally, you know, you become prone to infectious diseases and this type of thing. But these individuals who were unable to withstand the life, they started to move away from the forest fraternity, the forest setting, and then moving towards the edge of villages, where it was easier to get food, it was easier to get support, medicines. You know, you could get a little hut built, and you know, you weren't so far out that you couldn't get a little shack, little straw hut built. And so you had these more, I wouldn't say like weak-minded individual, but people who are more interested in, say, connecting to the local society, increasing their personal comfort, increasing their level of personal possessions, possibly increasing their personal wealth, which is something that you see arising in Thailand, Burma, you know, Sri Lanka, especially within the village fraternity. You know, many village monks are known for using money, but I don't make such an incredibly big deal about it. If they're using very, very small amounts of cash to buy, say, like a bus ticket, a train ticket, or maybe pick up something at the hardware store, but when they've got so much cash that they walk into a shop and they're buying say like smartphones or say like Gucci bags and really high class expensive items, and they have more money in their wallets than the poorest of their lay disciples, well, essentially that's morally wrong. Now, if you want to keep the strict standard, you don't you don't use money or carry money whatsoever. But I understand if people do, because if you're a monastic and you don't use money and you're in the position of a teacher and you travel, you're really in a very difficult situation, because you're constantly dependent on the lay fraternity. You have to constantly ask them for things. You've got to ask them for tickets and for to be picked up, from the airport, dropped off, and to cover your meals and medicines, and it just goes on and on and on. When you're outside, if you're a well-known teacher, it's not so difficult. You make yourself easy to look after, but if you're moving around internationally, and if you don't have a solid support network, eventually you'll get stuck. You know, when things go wrong, the plane, you know, say for example your flight gets cancelled, or you have to rebook a ticket, or things like you know you've got to make a phone call to actually check a pickup or check in with someone, and you haven't got a phone, and the phone cards, I got stuck in Sydney Airport for half a day because there were problems with my transport, and I had three different types of phone cards. And they didn't work on the machines in the airport, which were locked into to Telstra. And eventually, I had to ask to use somebody's smartphone, and then I had to reverse charges. And it took me an extra 5 to 6 hours to get from Sydney to Wollongong, and because I didn't have a phone. And some people just looked at me in disbelief. You know, you're traveling around and you haven't got a phone. And it's like, you know, you are completely irresponsible. And if you haven't got a phone, actually, they look down on you. They think you're a bit soft in the head. But, you know, you guys understand why the monks, you know, the majority of, especially the forest monks, depends on the person. Ajahn Brahm doesn't carry a phone, naturally doesn't use money or a credit card. Some senior teachers will, because when you get really, really stuffed up about two or three times, you know, you may carry a phone just to basically cover your butt. Yeah, because the thing is, once you've attained to the fourth stage as an arahant, because all fully enlightened beings, you're looking at full purification of mind. The difference between the arahants and the Buddhas, it's the level of spiritual parami. You know, they talk about the 10 paramis within the Theravadan fraternity, which you don't actually see in the suttas. It's not in the suttas. And the 6 paramis within the Mahayana system. The Buddha supposedly has got them to its maximum level. But that principle of that purification of mind, once you attain arahantship, you cannot be reborn in any realm whatsoever. There's no substrate. There's no underlying tendency or sense of self, or say, for choice of better words, impurity within the mind, the defilements in the mind, to bring you to rebirth again. Yeah, like I'm definitely not an expert on that one. But the Buddha said this is, and this is in the sutta, and I always go back to the suttas because it's almost foolproof. The Buddha said that no two Buddhas arise in what in one world system at any time. So you can argue the point. This is something I've got to check. I'll check on this one. I can't remember if it's one world system or the universe, because when you look at the chronology of the Buddhas with the expansion and contraction of the universe, supposedly there are 5 Buddhas within this particular lineage before this universe ends, and Gautama was number 4, and number 5 is Maitreya, and this is the listing you actually see in the chronology, that book, the chronology of the Buddhas, and the listings of the Buddhas going back through time, you know, through the expansions and contractions of the universe. But it's something I'll double check. But the reference, they talk about the expansion and contraction of the universe, and they talk about the arising of rising and ceasing of Buddhas through this process. So it seems that it's something I've got to check, but it indicates to me that only one Buddha arises within that universal system, within that the expansion and contraction of the universe, that universal system. Even though you've got like world systems within the universe, that I never ever saw it in print, that the Buddha stated in the suttas that two Buddhas can ever arise within one world system. The only references I've ever, like, I'm not a scholar by any means, I'm more into meditation, but I've never seen a reference which said that two Buddhas can actually arise within the universe together at any point in time when you look at that chronological sequence. But it's something it's worth looking into. I definitely wouldn't argue the point. It's certainly possible, but the reason why there was this historical and cultural reference to the Buddhas being male, when you look at it in a practical sense, if you have the female practitioners, one of the disadvantages of the female practitioners living in, say, like isolated locations, forest locations, living alone or even in small companies or small groups, that essentially, and a male problem. But women are subject to molestation and rape by males, culturally and historically. And if you have a woman living alone in the forest section, or as some kind of religious mendicant, it's almost guaranteed that she's going to be molested on some level at some point. Yeah, but it doesn't mean Jack. It's like you can be incredibly highly, if you're female, you could be a fully enlightened Buddha, but I can't say if that is going to be essentially give you full protection, full physical protection, for the rest of your life. Naturally, the Buddhas have. For example, a female Buddha who has whose faculties are developed to the highest level across the range, who has incredible psychic ability, ability to recollect, see other people's karma and the way people's karma crosses and connects for maybe short or long duration, that female person may be fully aware of dangers which are coming her way. But, I can't say that a person at that level will still not be subject to dangers. Not only male human beings, but also like wild animals, like tigers, bears, and elephants. It's very, very incredibly rare that even, say, monks, nuns, and especially the monks and nuns, you don't hear of many attacks, even in the forests and jungles in the early days, Thailand, Burma. I haven't heard much about the Sri Lankan fraternity, but it's very rare. It doesn't happen very often. Even if you've got like an elephant trail several hundred metres from your kuti, it's incredibly rare that a bull elephant will actually charge a kuti unless you antagonise the elephants. So, but I think the reasoning, one of the primary reasonings, was that the females had a limited ability to protect themselves, like in isolated locations. There's that sutta rendering that the Buddha said this, that even in villages, not only women practicing the religious life in seclusion, but in villages where small villages where there are large numbers of women and few men, that particular fraternity, can be subject to the the plundering, the mistreatment by bands of robbers, thieves, and other groups of say like ruffians. Yeah? That was actually within one. You can do it like a word search, and you'll see that particular sutta come up. But a reference in relation to this is when I was at Tan Achana Nun's place in Wat Mat Chan, he made references to female body. He puts a lot of emphasis on this, on both male and female bodhisattvas in higher realms of existence. And it is, you know, it is a technical, a potential that, you know, you can get a person who has attained enlightenment, you know, on the path, you know, with a body, not necessarily a full bodhisattva perspective, because I have heard it said that if a person, you know, this is even within the forest tradition fraternity, that if a person makes a very, very strong intention to save other beings before they're prepared to attain to nirvana, that will actually block them from realizing the sotapanna level. You know, that that will essentially obstruct the realization of mind. But he talked about enlightened people who were practicing similar, you know, both male and female, devas, you know, practicing along the lines with a bodhisattva mentality. And when you look at the way Sayacham Brahm lives his life, the amount of teaching and the service and the travel that he gives, you know, both in the community here, Dhammaloka, with the nuns, with the Bodhinyana, and also with the his international fraternity, he does an incredible amount of work, more than any other abbot, more than any other any of the Thai enlightened teachers. You know, he works much harder than any of these guys, and so. You know, I've heard people, Achyam Brahm, actually people label Achyam Brahm as a person with a bodhisattva mentality, you know, supporting as many people as he can, you know, through the course of his own practice. Let's have a look here. Okay, so point 7, there are 7 kinds of offerings made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis after the Tathagata has attained final Nibbana. This is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to a Sangha of bhikkhus. That is the third kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to a Sangha of bhikkhunis. This is the fourth kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift saying, appoint 70 bhikkhus and bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the fifth kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift saying, appoint 70 bhikkhus for me from the Sangha. This is the sixth kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift saying, appoint 70 bhikkhunis for me from the Sangha. This is the seventh kind of offering made to the Sangha. In future times, Ananda, there will be members of the clan who are yellow necks, immoral, of evil character, people who give gifts to those immoral persons for the sake of the Sangha. Even then, I say, an offering made to the Sangha is incalculable, immeasurable, and I say that in no way does a gift to a person individually even have greater fruit than an offering made to the Sangha. Anyone got any opinions on that one? All right, so if I take it down to the footnotes there, up to 1302, you've got the footnotes, so the MA states that a gift offered to an immoral bhikkhu taken to represent the entire Sangha is more fruitful than a gift offered on a personal basis to an arahant. But for the gift to have its highest intention or value, as far as the good karma, the return of the fruits of the good karma, its highest intention or value, the donor must take no account of the person's qualities, the personal qualities of the reciprocant, but must see them solely as representing the Sangha as a whole. So for example, with the lay disciples, if you gave to, say, one of the monastics, and your intention, this is the bottom line, your intention has to be very high-minded, that you give this person, you know, it could be, because there's different types of monks and nuns, but you have the purity of intention that you wish to give to, you know, the Sangha as a complete organization, not to the one individual. So that will take your personal merit to its higher level. So you don't personalize it. You're not giving to this person. You're not reflecting on the personal qualities of this individual, but you're giving to the Sangha of the four quarters, which is every single monastic across the different, you know, monasteries and temples, you know, I mean, right around the world, you know, so which is quite a large number of individuals. So there are four kinds. No one's got any opinions? Okay, this stuff's pretty deep. There are four kinds of purifications of offering. What for? There is the offering that is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. There is the offering that is purified by the receiver, not by the giver. There is the offering that is purified neither by the giver nor by the receiver. There is the offering that is purified both by the giver and by the receiver. And what is the offering that is purified by the giver, not by the receiver? Here the giver is virtuous, of good character, and the receiver is immoral, of evil character. Thus the offering is purified by the giver, not by the receiver. And what is the offering that is purified by the receiver, not by the giver? Here the giver is immoral, of evil character, and the receiver is virtuous, of good character. Thus the offering is purified by the receiver, not by the giver. And what is the offering that is purified neither by the giver nor by the receiver? Here the giver is immoral, of evil character, and the receiver is immoral, of evil character. Thus the offering is purified neither by the giver nor by the receiver. And what is the offering that is purified both by the giver and by the receiver? Here the giver is virtuous, of good character, and the receiver is virtuous, of good character. Thus the offering is purified both by the giver and by the receiver. These are the four kinds of purification of offering. So when you check the footnote reference, that point 1303 says the word purified has the meaning made fruitful. So fruitful. So you're looking at the karma vipaka, the value, the power of the merit, which will essentially return to you. And there's something I don't with this principle here. So the purification of both the giver and the receiver, that it appears to be, I haven't got a second reference on this one, it appears to be that they talk about the purity of the person giving the offering, but they talk about the purification factor, but they don't say that the actual kusala karma, the wholesome merit, is actually limited by the giver, even if the person is immoral. But at that point in time, they have the mind state where, you know, regardless of what kind of person I am still giving to the Sangha in its entirety. But I couldn't see a reference where they stated the karma vipaka, the merit would actually be limited regardless of the quality of the intention of the unwholesome person, because you can say for example you have a wholesome or unwholesome person giving to a community or a certain individual, but the person may be smart enough to realize that even if they're a dodgy person, that as long as I keep my intention incredibly high-minded, that the merit which comes back will be at its highest level. But I can't say whether that would actually make a difference to the vipaka, whether, you know, they talk about the offering being purified, but it wasn't said that it would actually affect the actual quality of the merit coming back, regardless of the person's station in life. Okay. Let's have a look. Okie dokie. That is what the Blessed One said. When the Sublime One had said that, the teacher said further. When a virtuous person to an immoral person gives with trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, the giver's virtue purifies the offering. When an immoral person to a virtuous person gives with untrusting heart a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, the receiver's virtue purifies the offering. When an immoral person to an immoral person gives with untrusting heart a gift unrighteously obtained, nor places faith that the fruit of action is great, neither's virtue purifies the offering. When a virtuous person to a virtuous person gives with trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, will come to full fruition. So I think this is the indication. When a passionless person to a passionless person gives with trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, is the best of worldly gifts. Right. But I'll probably double check that reference. It's not really that clear to me. They talk about, you know, they use these words, you know, where the offering is purified, but they don't relate that directly to the power of the merit which returns to you. I'll check in with Ajahn Brahmani, he possibly might know. So that last passage, with the footnotes, that 1304, so the last verse, this last verse refers to the gift one arahant gives to another arahant, even though his mind is purified and beyond karma. The act merely constitutes functional action which has no karmic result. So the as you understand, the mind state of both individuals, very, very pure and at its highest level, but there's no karmic effect which will essentially fruit for the fully enlightened disciple who gives to another individual at his level. You know, to give you an idea, Longpo Tui, who's been recognized as an arahant in Thailand for many years, like well over 30 years, he was supporting a monastery, a forest monastery, not far from him. I think it was about maybe one or maybe a couple of kilometers at the most, supporting a community there where the teacher was supposedly an old arahant, maybe in his late 80s, and he was, you know, he was very, quite feeble, very, very frail and feeble, but his mind was very, very powerful. And the Ajahn Longpo Tui's concern, and he would check, even though he wasn't physically present, but he would actually check the minds of the junior monks who were essentially like his nurses in the sangha, and he would check the his fraternity of junior monks to make sure they were practicing They were taking care of monastic references, residences. They were attending to the health and the welfare of their of the senior teacher there, who was very, very immobile, very frail. But even though his body was quite frail, that when Longpo Tui went to America for a series of teaching appointments, you know, and this was told to Achanyana, and Achanyana Dhamma wouldn't lie about this kind of thing, that when Longpo Tui came back and he went to visit, make sure that the old teacher was physically okay, and just to touch base, because he'd been away, he'd been in the States for, I think, easily well over 4 weeks, and after he returned to Thailand, he dropped into the monastery and just a small chit chat. He said, "I've just come back from the States, you know, from some teaching engagements, and I did a little bit of travelling around the US, and I went here and went there." And he was just talking about some of the things that he saw, like on the landscape. He visited like New York City, and he saw, you know, things like the Brooklyn Bridge and the Empire State Building, and some very, very prominent landmarks that you see in the major cities in the US. And when he mentioned this, that the old teacher, he said I've seen those things too. And Longpo Tui laughed. He said, how did you know? He said, well, he said, when you went overseas, he said, I wanted to check up on you to make sure that you were getting enough rest and the alms food was okay. And he said, basically, I was following you around. He said, I just projected my mind from his little forest monastery in Thailand, you know, over to the United States, and he was just like following Longpo Tui around, and could see exactly where he was going and what he was doing, and the size of the fraternity that he was teaching. So they both had a bit of a chuckle about that one. So, did anyone have any additional views and opinions on anything whatsoever? Yep.
I think. Okay. I think that when we.
It's very, very soft. It's very,
yeah,
very soft.
I think when we were discussing about the Bodhisattva and the chance of occurring at the same time in the world system, I think we're missing a little bit the point. A Bodhisattva is someone who is about to become a Buddha, who is about to reestablish the sasana. So I don't think that it's a matter of physical dimensions that define what a Bodhisattva and a Buddha is, but it's a matter of circumstances and, of course, the intention for those circumstances to arise in the appropriate way. So I think that I completely agree that Mahayana make a big confusion when they start dividing the world between Savakas and Bodhisattvas. And that's how they see. They see us as Savakas, and they see themselves as Bodhisattvas. But when you look at the suttas, Buddha said that you will never have two Buddhas at the same time, because the Buddha is the one who has accumulated such a high level of parami that he brings back the sasana, or he brings back the Dhamma. Some bring with the Sangha, with the Vinaya, or some bring with a very weak Vinaya, and the Vinaya lasts only for 2-3 generations. So I think that the point here is just like, yes, you will never have two Buddhas at the same time, because there must be first one who will come, bring back the Dhamma to human beings, and that defines him as the Buddha. And in terms of locality, if the world systems are so far away and we cannot even know about them, I don't think that there's a point in speculating about it. That, right?
Yeah, but it's a key principle within the Mahayana doctrine. You know, it's part of their formulation and their historical formulation, and they don't necessarily question this. And you know, it may undermine the Mahayana teaching. You know, not only just with this business with say Buddhism and other world systems, but also even within like Pure Land Buddhism, like Amitabha Buddha, you know, and the Western Paradise. If you don't believe there are Buddhas in other world systems, that essentially that just undermines the Amitabha's Pure Land also. So it's not you know, with some Mahayana practitioners, I mean, you know, they you start to pull the carpet out from under their feet, you know, if you undermine those essential principles that they have. But my kind of the way I think, because I've had people from the Mahayana tradition that say lay disciples come upstairs and talk about the differences between Theravada and Mahayana, and they say that their brothers and sisters are Pure Land Buddhists, but they're Theravadan. You know, they come from a Chinese family, but they practice the Theravadan system. And the, you know, what was my opinion on this? I mean, were their siblings? Was mum and dad their brothers and sisters? Were they spiritually limited by following the Mahayana belief system? The historical cultural belief system, and but essentially, when it comes down to tin tacks, that as long as you are practicing the Noble Eightfold Path to the best of your ability, essentially you really can't go wrong. You know, you practice the Sila Samadhi Panya. Under the principles of the Eightfold Path, and that is the complete path, and that will take you as far as you're prepared to go. It's the amount of like effort, the kind of energy and the time that you're prepared to put in to develop yourself personally. So, you know, I've met plenty of Pure Land Buddhists and people from the Vietnamese and Chinese traditions, and some of these people, they're very, very good people. They're some of the best people you could meet, even within the Buddhist fraternity. So I would never, I never ever argue any points. I never do this. I never argue points of doctrine or undermine them or say, think, oh, these guys, you know, they're. Because some of them, they're more engaged, they're more socially engaged, they're more engaged in the world. Sometimes they drive cars, they have their own money, they cook their own food, and this and that. It's not, you know, in order to be, as one of the senior Tibetan nuns said when I was at Santi Monastery, you know, she cooks her own food, and she has her own vehicle and whatnot, but she works. You know, she's very, very busy within the Buddhist fraternity, and she works quite hard, you know, on a social level. She doesn't have a lot of time for personal practice, but you know, and she's out there, you know, basically strutting her stuff. You know, she's in robes, and she's a teacher, and you know, she's committed to being of service to others, and she's out there, and she's doing it. So. You know, I'm sitting in my peaceful little monastery, and I'm not out there very often. You know, when I was at Bundanoon, it was mainly Ajahn Sujata who was teaching in Sydney on a regular basis on weekends, and plus his international teaching appointments as well. So, you know, I would never put a bad word against her on those particular points. But you know, but the thing is, actually argued that a small argument came up between a couple of the members, and one of the nuns, you know, the Tibetan nuns, said straight out, look, you know, we're not dependent on other people to cook for us. You know, we can work independently. We are, you know, like freelance. You know, they keep the precepts to the best of their ability, you know, according to their own tradition, which may be quite flexible, but it's only when you're, say, for example, if you know, you've got different Buddhist traditions and you've got different interpretations of vinaya, of precept structure, but the bottom line is that if you follow a certain cultural tradition. And or a certain, you know, say precept formula or mode of behaviour, and it's only when you get into trouble, when things start to go wrong, then you may have to pull back and just review the direction you're going, because the thing is that, you know, if you're driving a car, And you've already had a couple of accidents, you know, like the warning signs are there. You know, when like in Thailand, in what's his name again? How'd it come to mind? Let's see. That monk who was disrobed in Yantra. That monk who was disrobed in Thailand, who fled to the United States and ended up in prison for a short time. He was driving a vehicle in one of the local towns, and he went through a stoplight at a last minute, and one or two seconds, and he had a collision with a woman driver, and you know he killed that lady. She died, and so he ended up being, he was held in detention through the legal process. But you know, that's one of the potential dangers. Or say, for example, you've got monks who have, and this happens in Thailand on a regular basis, you know, monks have big wallets, you know, fat with cash, you know, certain monks, and there's a computer plaza in Bangkok, which has like three levels of very, very comprehensive, so like company operation, and you know, you could have easily 100 to 200 monks in there, you know, buying their gear, their laptops, their you know, their God knows whatever they got, you know, could be smartphones or this or that, and you know, and just, you know, hand, you know, just they've got their own money and they can basically buy what they like. So it's you know, I'm not calling it like a criminal offence, but it's like it starts to get a bit you know, a little bit dodgy, because you're relying on the support. You know, in its pure sense, once you free yourself from the support of the lay community and start to move like an independent monastic practitioner, then the potential for corruption, mismanagement, and for things to go wrong, the potential is there. But when the monks and nuns make themselves fully dependent on the lay fraternity, then you've got checks and balances in place. You know, so you know, if somebody, you know, so for example, somebody made gave me an invitation for something, you know, if I needed something, whatever, you know, but I would still be very, very careful, because within the understanding, you know, you have to check with people, you know, exactly how far they, you know, how much support they're prepared to give, and in what area, you know, their support may be restricted only to the four requisites and nothing else. Or say, for example, your Kindle dies. And you know, like I won't dispute a point with things like Kindles and tablets, because they're incredibly useful for study. I do a lot of my study with my own tablet, word search, text to speech, and I've absorbed a lot more sutta material with the tablet than I have in any other format. And I can research. I've got thousands. I've got about 6,500 documents, and I don't even have to even go into the library. I've got so much material. But yeah, so you need the checks and balances by the monastics being fully dependent on the lay people. You know, the monastics tend to live a more suitable livelihood or lifestyle. You know, once you get too independent, you can just do your own thing. You can get up to all sorts of little tricks, and you know, you've got to be there has to be limits, because human beings, you know, who aren't purified on the level of meditation, and they're not purified on the level of the path, you know, they're really just capable of anything, you know. Because I mix with the local prison, and some of the stories that these guys tell me, there's, you know, it's pretty wild stuff. So yeah, but the thing is with the interdependency is a good point, because when the monastics are dependent on the lay disciples, you have to maintain that cordial relationship. You have to maintain that connection. And then essentially that connection pulls the lay disciples into your field of practice. And then you become part of my practice, naturally, because I'm 19 reigns now, so I have to get out there and teach to a minimum, absolutely minimum degree. And I'm pushing it a bit more these days. I'm getting far more confident. The lay disciples become part of the monastics practice, and they get the benefit of the practice that the monks and nuns are undertaking. They can support the lay community in different ways at different levels. Any other questions? Yeah, that one there, that particular sutta though, that was a pretty deep one. I had to read that one over several times.
The last paragraph, when a passionless person gives. So there are two Arians giving.
Two Arahants. One giving some offering to another. It could be any kind of community support. As I mentioned that story previously with Long Putui and that old Arahant in the local nearby forest monastery. But there's no karma vipaka. There's no good karma which returns. Actually, I better get this right. When a passionless person draws placing faith, that gift I say is the best of worldly gifts. So when you're looking at the level of purity and the let me get my mind around this one. It's like you've taken it to its high level of purity on both sides, but the Arahant on the karmic level, on the karma, say the karma vipaka, the cause and effect principle, that particular karmic effect realistically it should reach him in the current life, up to the time of his death. Because, just because he's an Arahant won't block that wholesome karma from returning. So, for example, one monastery supported another with on a level of say building material for projects. Could be anything. Could be bricks, slab, anything. And that wholesome karma that the Arahant teacher gives to another community returns to him, but it's not personalized, because the Arahant who gives has no sense of self. He may recognize the fruition principle, the good karma returning, but he's neither elated or, for choice of better words, elated or depressed. He's completely unaffected, completely unattached to the result of that action. Even though he has full firm belief, he's penetrated those very deep insights, but it's not like a personal. I can't think of the right words. Experience the way when the karma returns to him, he doesn't personalize it. It's just the fruit of action, and that's all it is. He understands the full process, but it's quite impersonal, because his sense of self has disappeared completely. Okie dokie. Okay, we'll wrap it up there if you like. Thank you for being so patient and attentive.